My name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. Don't clap, dummy. It's very unusual for me to be up here speaking with Hank sitting there. Oh, Christ, I picked up the wrong notes. Well, I say, if you can't hurt an Al-Anon, why even talk? I want to thank Annie. She has been my dinner partner tonight and a very delightful one. I really enjoyed her talk. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to see a number of people who I've known in Southern California, and some of you I've met in Grants Pass a few years ago, and one lady I met in Fairbanks, Alaska. Remember that night in the snowbank up there? AA in Fairbanks is an unusual place. It's the only place I know. I'm not saying it's a long way from the beaten path, but they opened the meetings there by reading a portion of Chapter 5 from Field and Stream magazine. I want to thank Obie for a yummy dinner, and I think it's very clever of him to, by the time you get to where the meat is, your plate is full of salad and you can't get any of it. But that lady cuts as fine as anything I ever saw, and I want to congratulate her. I bet she's the one that did with the loaves and fishes, too. Gotta be a robot. No human can cut that thin. And oddly enough, I bring you greetings. I was having dinner a little over a week ago, at a man's home who used to live in Portland. And I mentioned to him I was coming to Portland to talk, and he said to send you all his love. And that's your old friend Bill Walton. I'm not telling you that he's good or bad. I'm just saying I had dinner at his home, and if you like vegetarian meals, it was a grand meal. If you're a rabbit. But it was very good, and he said he always liked Portland, and he didn't like some of the aspects of the team, but he loved the people in Portland. So he said, be sure to send him my love, so I just did it. He's not an AA, he's got real problems. I want to thank Fred and Pat for being gracious enough to come to the airport and selecting me out of the crowd. And I didn't know how they do it. He said, you're the only guy that got fag white shoes on. So you immediately know he's a Southern California speaker. One thing about Southern California AA, you know, in most groups around the country, they use the 12 steps to separate the men from the boys. In our groups, we sometimes use a crowbar, too. Just think, if we had sold 5 more tickets for this drawing, I could have had breakfast. But I'm glad to be here. I come from a little town, much smaller than this, up in northern Wisconsin, a little town called Eau Claire. And when I was a boy, I had a great zest to see what was on the other side of the horizon. And I was raised in a very, very strict religious home, the Norwegian Lutheran Church. I don't know if you even have Norwegian Lutheran churches here, but it's pretty strict, I'll tell you. You know, I hear a lot of AA people get up. There seem to be a lot of Catholics in AA, and they always say they're the strictness of the Catholic Church, they say it or imply it, drove me to drink. And in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, if you were a Norwegian Lutheran and you couldn't make it, and you needed an easier, softer way, you became a Catholic. Yeah. That was for the quitters. But I was raised in a very, very strict, protected home and protected church, and early in the Second World War, I had a great zest to see what was going on. I was a junior in high school, and I was 15 years old, and I was small and skinny and had a lot of pimples on my face, all ready to go at any given moment. But I was one of the slickest guys in our homeroom, I felt. And I'd gone to the movies every Saturday and Sunday and saw all about the world. I read Life magazine, and I just felt I'm ready to make my move. And you've never been the same since you found Clarisil. Well, so I just told my folks I was going to hitchhike to Superior, Wisconsin to visit my aunt. And instead I just hitchhiked to San Francisco. I had no idea how far it was. I knew it was the other side of Minneapolis somewhere, and I looked on my map, and it was 3 green states and 2 yellow states and a blue state. And I thought, it'll be fun to see them anyway. And fortunately, I got one ride most of the way, or I never would have got there. And I got there, and I ran into a guy right away. He said, you know, if you're 15, you can't do anything. He said, he showed me how to prove I was 16. And he sent me to the Coast Guard office up on Market Street, and they were crying for merchant seamen. The war had only been on a year, but they were very short of everything. And I went up there. It was just like being in fantasy land. I hadn't even been to Milwaukee yet. And here I was in San Francisco in the ocean. And I went up there, and they had me sign an application for seamen's papers. Of course, at 16, I had to have my parents' permission. So I took the application around the block and had my parents sign it. And brought it back, and they issued me some temporary seamen's papers, and they referred me to the National Maritime Union down on Montgomery Street, and I went down there, and they signed me up there, crying for seamen for their merchant ships, and I signed a waiver that my union dues would be taken out of my first check. I didn't have any money. They referred me to the Embarcadero, and that night, the very night I got into San Francisco, I was on a load of torpedo warheads going to the South Pacific. And about 2 hours out of port, it suddenly struck me, this is not quite it either. I realized I'd made a terrible mistake. And I sidled up to the captain and said, I really appreciate this opportunity, but we got a big English test Monday, and I really should get back. I guess he wished me well. He told me to luck off. And he told me to get to your forecastle. And I didn't know what a forecastle was, but it sounded ominous to me. Turns out to be that's a room on a ship where men sleep. That's all it is. And I went in this forecastle, and small and skinny and pimply-faced, and I was stuck in there with 3 of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, numbskull can ever be stuck with. And these type of people are called men. And I could just see by the way they looked at me, they thought, what is this? And I tried to ease the tension. I told them all the funny jokes we used to tell at study hall. They really didn't go for him. Why don't you get in your goddamn bunk and dummy up, you know? And I lay in my bunk, and that ship was moving, and the earth was out of sight. And it was, I just felt so terrible. I wanted to be home. I wanted to be my mother. I wanted to be my grandmother. Anyway, just anywhere. I just saw no way out. Grandmother. I wanted to be with you, dear. And these guys were talking, and these guys, I lay in my bed listening to these guys talk, and they were talking about their experiences they'd had while the ship was in San Francisco. And I was just appalled. I had never heard anything like that. I figured they were Catholics, is what I figured. And this was the closest I had ever come to sinners, and to my knowledge. And they were talking about things that were just dirty. Now, I don't want to leave the wrong impression. Even at the age of 15 in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, I'd had sex. But I had been apprehensive, and I'd been afraid, and I'd been alone. I didn't know these pictures came to life in San Francisco. And I was having a terrible time on this ship, and later that same evening, when I felt as bad as I ever felt, one of these guys went to his locker, into his sea bag, and took out a bottle of whiskey, something I had never seen close up. And he said to one of his friends, he said, "You want a little snort?" I go, "Yeah." "You want a little snort?" "Yeah." And he turned to me, he had a singularly unpleasant look on his face. Now that I'm a little more sophisticated, I would call it a patronizing look. But I didn't know what a patronizing look was. It was just an unpleasant look. I remember he said, "How about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort?" And I looked up at him. I didn't say anything, but I could just feel my face getting red and my watery blue eyes blazing. And I thought to myself, "You big dummy. Haven't you ever seen a Lutheran?" Lutherans don't drink whiskey. And even if they did drink whiskey, I wouldn't drink whiskey because I promised both my mother and grandmother that I would never drink whiskey. Every time I mentioned my grandmother, she laughed. "I don't care what you say about me, but don't laugh at my grandmother." And in addition to that, I thought I had a great knowledge of the world. Her and I knew nothing, but I thought I did. And I learned it all by going to the Badger Theater every Saturday afternoon and the State Theater every Sunday afternoon, seeing all the movies. And in that era, the heroes of movies never drank. Bad guys drank. Good guys didn't drink. So I just assumed that good guys didn't drink. Errol Flynn never took a drink in his life, to the best of my knowledge. Not in Sherwood Forest, he didn't. Bad guys like Basil Rathbone and Claude Rains and that crowd, let's go kill Robin Hood. Buck Jones never drink. Always some rustler named Slade down at the Lone Star. There's no chance people like me with my conditioning are ever going to drink. And that's what made me so upset when that big guy stuck that bottle in my face. He said, "You think you're man enough to have a little snort?" And I just looked right up at him and I said, "God damn right." Because I've always been a little weak under pressure, too. And I had my first drink of alcohol that day. It was just terrible. It burned my mouth, and it burned my throat, and burned my stomach, and burned my stomach, and burned my throat, and burned my mouth, and burned his shirt the last I saw him. And I felt so humiliated and embarrassed, not even so much by being sick, but their scornful laughter. There's nothing in the world that I know of that makes you feel worse than when you're feeling inadequate to have someone expose your inadequacy. And that's nothing to do with being a kid. That's something to do with being the human being. And I just felt so bad. And they laughed and smirked and ridiculed, I thought. And all the way across the Central Pacific, every day when that room was empty, that forecastle, I would sneak into that guy's sea bag to take a drink of that whiskey to see if I could hold it down, because I was under the illusion. That's something else you might think about in life. When everything is going to hell, human beings usually have to find something, a hook to put it on, to say, this is the reason. Sometimes you find people coming to AA and they're still using a hook from 20 years ago. That was the reason. But you can't just say everything is amorphously bad. It's because of that or that. And I got the feeling that because I'd thrown up that alcohol, they thought I was a punk. And I completely overlooked the fact they thought I was a punk before I took a drink. So it had nothing to do with that. But I tried to hold, and I'd drink it and throw it up and wipe it up so they wouldn't know. And the next day I'd do it again and again and again. I remember a day out of Pearl Harbor, I took a drink of that warm slop and it burned my mouth and burned my throat and burned my stomach and stayed there. I thought, now if I could just do this and not make a face. Oh, terrible. And just about then I had the first experience that I came to think was what life was about. That is, I've heard it. People try to describe this in AA 100 times. I never heard it really described, because you can't describe this, but I hear some people say that feeling when for the first time you start to get warm from the inside out. or some ladies say, when I'm young and pretty again, or when guys say, when I'm handsome or strong or tough or tall, or and the point where guys and girls can sit and look in the back bar and watch yourself turn into something desirable with one more drink in that mirror. And the, I suppose the feeling I always thought about it, it's almost a temporary omnipotence. Just, boom, just, I never had that feeling before. You know, it's a funny thing. Our book, Alcoholics Anonymous, describes that. I had no idea that alcohol was doing something special in my body. I had no idea. How would anybody know? And our book describes people who grow to maturity and drink for a number of years, and then eventually alcohol begins to do something special in their body. And they call that crossing the invisible line, but you don't know it when you're going through it. Since the book was written, it's discovered a lot of people who don't drink that long before they... There's a lot of younger people who drink a few years before, and then they cross the invisible line. And there's some of us who seem to have alcohol do something special in our body the first time we drink it. You're across the line the first time out of the chute, but you don't know it. But it was just a remarkable feeling. And then eventually I got sick and threw up, and I wiped it up. But I look back on that moment as a great moment because I suppose you might describe it as, that was the first time in my life that I ever felt the way men looked. And that was just great. And many years later, I had my last drink, and I'd been around a lot, and I'd become slick, and I'd got a lot older and traveled a lot and done a lot of things. If someone said to me, why did you take that drink? I had a number of reasons, that depending on how I felt that day. I could describe to them, based on my psychoanalysis, the conflict between the parent and the child for the adult in my psyche, and why that needed to be resolved with the intense sensitivities I had. Or I could talk to them based on my metaphysical studies of the Uspenskayan knowledges that had set me apart from the ordinary people and gave me perceptions that left me staggered at the ignorance of those about me. Or, laugh if you want, it's not easy. Or I could talk about my studies, and I could refer to my studies in philosophy and talk about how I felt having discovered in Nietzsche that I was an Übermensch, and somehow or other I was set aside from people, and they and their ignorance and stupidity tear people like me apart because they can't understand I'm above them. Some days, when people say, why do you take that drink? I said, just another shitty day. That's all right. But there's a number of reasons, I'll tell you. I had many reasons for taking my last drink, but I suppose in looking back now, I think it would be relatively safe to say, I never would have guessed it at the time, but in looking back, I think it would be safe to say, I took my last drink for exactly the same reason I took my first drink, only I didn't know it. I drank to feel the way men looked, and to keep myself together, and had no idea about it. Later in the war, after I was a kid, I tried to learn to drink a little bit, and I didn't go crazy and do all those things. I just tried to drink because it made me feel more manly. And there's nothing wrong with a little skinny kid on a ship out in the Pacific drinking to feel like a man or a grown-up. But when you're getting old and bald and wrinkled, and your children are grown-up, you shouldn't have to drink to feel grown-up then, somehow. There's something wrong. But later in the war, I went in the Navy, and when I was in the Navy, I took some examinations, and right after the war was ended, I was in a hospital in Fleet City, California, which enabled me to get a high school equivalency, so I didn't have to go back to Eau Claire High School anyway. And I went to college, and I got married in college, and had a couple of children. I was a member of a national championship team, and I was editor of the yearbook, and I had interest in a lot of things, and I went out in the world, and I became a sports writer. And sports writers and newspaper people didn't make much in those years and years ago. They don't make a hell of a lot now, but they made less then. And I had a tremendous problem, kind of, because I had a growing family. I had, in a moment of weakness, I had let my entire family down and married a Catholic. And I heard about it, too, I'll tell you. And my wife was a charming, lovely girl, but today the Catholic Church is against birth control. Over 30 years ago, they were really against birth control. And I said, well, my God, we can't have children all the time. And she told me, she used to give me lectures that she got from her priest on the rhythm system. And I never could pick up the beat. I just... I needed Lawrence Welk there to go one and a two and, you know, something. So I had to make more money, and I got a job in a company writing sales correspondence. Then they liked my writing, so they put me in the advertising department. Eventually I got the advertising agency work, and I traveled around the country writing. And I did fairly well, intermittently quite successful. And my family grew, and everything was all right. Except all of those years, I had a lot of emotional pain I felt. And it wasn't, I thought about that a lot of times. I used to think, am I really different from people, this different? And I'll tell you, I don't think that I ever felt so different. I didn't feel my emotions were different, but it always... It seemed to be my emotions were more on the surface than other people's. That their emotions had a layer of insulation somehow that mine didn't have. That I have a tendency to react to things. I remember telling a guy at a bar one day, joking with him, saying, when I came off the assembly line, I got to that operation where God puts on the insulation. And somebody said, hey, God. And God said, yeah. And I went right on by. Ah, screw him. He's a Norwegian. Yeah. And it just seemed to me that my emotions were more reacting than other people's. That's kind of an interesting thing. Pardon me. Wasn't that interesting? Now I'll throw up. See what you think of that. All human beings in the world, I am sure, every human being that's rational, occasionally gets in situations where they feel insecure or in strange environmental situations or new things or something where it's afraid, new job, new situations of some sort, where they feel a little insecure. People like us have a tendency to, since we seem to have in our alcoholism a streak of insecurity that is a little more prevalent, have a tendency to feel insecure a little more often. But the one thing that people have a tendency to do if they get in an insecure situation is if you're not sure how you're doing compared against these people around you, you instinctively, without even being aware of it, compare yourself against them to see how you match up. Now, that's a very common thing. Alcoholics do it a lot. There's only one thing wrong with it, is that it is always an invalid comparison. Whether you think yourself superior or inferior or equal, it's always an invalid comparison. Because the one thing the insecure person never thinks about is that I am comparing my insides against their outsides. I am comparing my raw meat against the defenses they spent 20 years building to conceal their raw meat. So no matter how I slice it, it's always an invalid comparison. And if you're insecure a lot, you do it a lot. And the more you do it, the more different you feel. So you wind up feeling that you are completely different from most people. I look over my life, I don't recall ever seeing anybody who looked as sensitive as I felt. I don't recall seeing anybody who looked as though they lay awake at night having a difficulty getting to sleep while their brain raced trying to figure out how to get one up on those pukes tomorrow. I don't recall seeing anybody who looked as though their lonelinesses were as poignant as mine. You know, there's two forms of loneliness. You know, one is kind of delicious. It's when you're sitting around feeling sorry for yourself. Maybe you could be in a bar playing the same record over and over again and thinking about her. Trying to remember what her name was, what town it was. Or you can, another classic way, sit at home and drink and play a record. Sometimes, you know, if you're really a sentimentalist, you can sing along with the sad parts. And it's just, I don't know what young people do today singing along those goddamn rock records. But in my day, I remember a lot of times I've sat there and sang along. Birds fly over the rainbow. And it's just so sad and so low. It's just so what? There's a kind of an ecstasy to it. It's just so. It's like having your own portable cross. You just set it up. The type of feeling that bothered me a great deal was a feeling of loneliness. I never identified as loneliness because you wouldn't think of it as loneliness. But that's when you have those same kind of feelings in the middle of crowds. And you just feel alienated from the people around you. And you wouldn't even think to say, I feel very lonely. Because how can you be lonely when you're jammed in with people? It's like being sitting halfway somewhere in the middle of this audience and feeling lonely. And it said, don't be crazy. How can you be lonely with all these people? But that's the form of loneliness that was the most uncomfortable to me, although I never could identify it until I got working on getting over it. I never saw anybody who looked as though they suffered from the resentments I felt towards injustice. Young people today think they're the first ones who ever fought for justice. I fought for justice before it was cute to fight for justice. Yeah, like the young people today, I stood out there and many people around me crying out to the world, justice! Justice for all mankind! And like the young people today, I also said, if there's not enough to go around, I'll take mine now and we'll give them theirs a little later. You know. They wouldn't know what to do with it anyway, those goddamn flakes. I'll tell you one thing, if you're in one of your justice, fighting for justice phases, you will discover something as you get a few more miles on the track that you find you don't cry out for justice anymore. You cry out, mercy! Mercy! Because yeah. One day you come upon that staggering conclusion. Justice is not that situation based on how you want things. Justice is that situation based on how you deserve things. And I'm not willing to settle for what I deserve, goddammit. I gotta have more than that. But when you resent things, you resent people who have authority because it just doesn't seem fair. I resent a lot of people I work for. I've resented. I resent people who have the power to promote no talent brown nosers and hold back men of integrity who will not sell out, who can't even get a goddamn chance to sell out. That's not fair. I've had a lot of emotions. It seems to me they're right on top, and other people's emotions either are buried or they're dull. And these are difficult emotions if we want to be something. So I did a lot of things. I got into psychoanalysis almost 30 years ago. At that time, it wasn't chic. You had to be a seeker for emotional balance. And a lot of people in AA put down psychoanalysis. I just loved it. Because that was the first time I really understood intellectually that I had been hurt by forces beyond my control. Well, I remember how staggered I was to hear how I had been warped by the Depression. And I hadn't even been aware there had been a Depression. I remember my doctor saying to me one time, he said, Mr. Emerson, you mean to say at that time, I guess he was talking about 1935, He said, "You mean to say at that time you didn't even have a bicycle?" I thought about that for 2 months. It's amazing what I've made of myself, but God, what I could have been if I'd had a decent childhood. I just had a whole picture in my mind. I could just see everyone in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, riding their bicycles up and down the street. One little tousled-haired, blue-eyed, apple-cheeked little fellow saying, "Have a good time, fellas. I'll be all right. It's warping me, but it's all right." Took me 2 months to remember. That isn't the way it was at all. Nobody in Eau Claire had a bicycle. I didn't know I didn't have a bicycle because nobody had one. One kid had a bicycle. We thought he was a sissy and beat him up. There's only one. I learned so much in psychoanalysis. It really is wonderful because you learn so much about what got you the way you are that it almost blots out the fact everything is going to hell. It's just, it's like something that happened to me years later. It's like peeing your pants on a street corner. It serves no lasting purpose, but it makes you feel warm while you're doing it. Until the next cold wind blows. There's only one thing, you know, in psychoanalysis, at least for people like me, I don't mean to put down psychoanalysis. I have nothing against psychiatrists. I sponsor a couple of them. And they're a pain in the ass, I'll tell you. But for people like me, being in psychoanalysis is like being on the deck of the Titanic after you hit the iceberg. Everybody else rows away, and I want to stay and see exactly how I got here. And you may wind up with the answer. You say, "I've got the answer! Ha-ha! God damn it!" It doesn't do any good to have the answer when you're going down, because it just doesn't help.
Okay. No cocaine before the meeting's for you anymore.
Another time I was working on these emotions, I got into metaphysics, and I was deeply into them. I had to be a seeker, boy, because I got to, at one point, for the best of my knowledge, I was one of 6 people in the whole state of Texas who knew truth. And the other 5 were just crap heads. And it got very cold and lonely at the top for me. And it was almost a relief when they put me away finally. I read philosophy. I did a lot of things. I tried everything I knew that any pseudo-intellectual can do. But nothing ever was as... I look back at my life, nothing was quite as helpful to me on a continuing basis as just a few drinks. That's why I drink. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I went to ANA almost 30 years ago. And, you know, those guys take 2 beers and jump out of bushes on passing nuns. You know, they're weird. I am, unfortunately, cursed with the ability to spot crap heads and seem to be surrounded by them a lot. And if I could just find the time, the place where I should be, I'd get there. And sometimes these people put so much steam on you in their ignorance and unfeelingness and insensitivity that sometimes I have been driven to drink more than I planned. I have been known to be drunky-poo. And then comes the ultimate irony of all life. You will discover this. The very same crapheads who are making your life miserable are always among the first who want to talk to you about your drinking. You can always remember, they got little thin blue lips. They say things like, "Don't you know you have a family? Don't you want to work here anymore? I've done so much for you, and this is how you've repaid us. Is this the way you want to look to God?" And it really, the only answer I ever learned to that was screw you.
Yeah.
It isn't much of an answer, but... And sometimes when I'm being put upon by these blue-lipped, blue-nosed pukes, I have a tendency to brood. And when I brood, bizarre things happen because I'm pushed beyond my strength. For instance, one spring I was... It's nice to have a buzzer go off when the bathroom's open. Now I've lost my place and I have to start over. My name is Clancy. But one spring I was a junior Chamber of Commerce Young Man of the Year in the suburb of Chicago, and I had a home and a family and a yard and dog, and they figured I had a lot of potential. That's a terrible word after a while, but I unfortunately, it turned out I was able to perceive that town was full of crap heads and I was surrounded by them, and they were unfair to me, and I really had a lot of heartaches, and they were holding me back. And through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, by the end of that same year, 11 months later, I was playing piano in a whorehouse in San Francisco. Now, I'm not putting that down. You know, it's different strokes for different folks, we say. But it's very hard to work that into an advertising resume later. That's why many people in AA have resumes with big holes that say self-employed during this time. Went to school at a school now no longer there. But I reformed. That was one of the, I used to blame the Lutheran Church for that. It always seemed so unfair. I was trained all my life to be good. That's all I was ever trained for. Catechized. Learned to pray in Norwegian. That's spiritual overdrive. You know. We used to laugh at all those kids at St. Pat's across the street praying in Latin and just knowing God is saying, huh? Huh? Yeah. But I was trained to be good, but wasn't given the strength to stay good. And I had a natural flair for evil, it turned out. But the church had instilled such a conscience in me, I couldn't enjoy it very long. And it's just terrible, you know. I heard an old guy say one time, well, remember this, newcomers, when one door closes, another door opens. And I went to reference, Jesus, how about all those guys that spent their whole life in the hall? I hear the doors opening, but I ain't there when they're doing it. So I reformed again. My family and wife and kids were up in Wisconsin on a farm, so I ran a guy in the San Francisco, I've been in the Navy with, and we went to Texas. And I reform all the way, boys. Just, I'm going to make it good. And another spring, I was working days as copy chief of an advertising agency. At night, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Not bad for a guy who used to hitchhike into town last year. And I was writing a weekly sports thing for the El Paso Times, and my wife and I reunited, and as usual, 9 months and 10 seconds later, we had a baby. I became a distributor for the church. I like to think that I have single-handedly caused the charismatic movement worldwide. And I was doing fine, except it turns out El Paso's full of crap heads. It really is. If it weren't for Juarez, El Paso would be untenable. And so with all the pressures on me, I used to go to El Juarez once in a while just to relax. Because I had a lot of pressures on me. One day the dean of the university called me in with those thin little blue lips. So I understand you've been acting bizarrely in Juarez. But anybody says that to you, don't even try to explain, because it just saved your breath. I was tempted to explain to him, but I knew it wouldn't do any good, so I didn't. But I could have told him. unlike your square, Babbitt-like goofs you have on this faculty, some of us are creative, sensitive people. And somehow, when I'm under pressure, and I go to Juarez, and I go into the Chinese palace, and I stand on the bar, balancing it on one foot at 3 o'clock in the morning, holding a glass of tequila and a lime and some salt, and I sing my little song. Yo soy el maestro de los locos en Chihuahua. God damn it, that relaxes people. Like so I had to hold my job, I had to go on the wagon. And at that time, my wife was pregnant, so I had to stay on the wagon. That's when I got into metaphysics, but finally it just got so scrambled, I was so depressed week after week, and no way to relieve it, that one day I just tried to commit suicide, and died literally for, I guess, a couple of minutes, until somebody got my heart started again, and they examined me and classified me as a schizoid depressive, and sent me to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. Now, I thought I'd been depressed before. I wasn't there for 30 days or 90 days. I was there till I got well, which has a tendency to stretch out with people like me. And I might have been there yet. Some guy saved my life. He said, I remember when I just first got there, I just sit there looking at the wall thinking, oh, my God, how'll I ever get out of here? And he said, he told me never try to run away from there because there's an escape-proof nut house. And I could just feel my heart start. Oh, is it? And it took me just 2 weeks to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over the fence. And the fox was loose in West Texas. And the only sad thing about that is, what the guy said is really true. It is an escape-proof nut house, but you don't know till you get out, which sounds unusual. I don't know if you've ever been to West Texas, but you suddenly realize they can see you running for 3 days. Then you do. And you feel like such a dumbbell in your white bathrobe. Just, it's just a matter of time till the field glasses pick you up. Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. Boom, snatch your back. So I spent the rest of that year on the electric shock, because that's what they do when you get disturbed at that time in Texas. Well, the next year, I was thinking there must be some other way out of here. And by a great stroke of good luck, they instituted the first alcoholic ward in the state of Texas in that hospital as an experiment. And by that time, my memory had come back. When you have a lot of shock, it goes for a while, but it comes back. And I remember, when I heard that there was an AA in there, I knew I had him, maybe. Because I'd been to AA a lot. Because when people don't understand emotions and all they can do is see you're drinking, they think your problem is drinking. And they say things like, why don't you go to A&A? They're doing wonderful work, you know. And it's a place to go. AA is a great place. At least you can spend a couple weeks looking as though you're reforming without having to reform. I remember coming home telling my wife, well, Charlotte, I've gone back to A&A. Oh, wonderful. They want me to taper off. That was before Al-Anon screwed it up for everybody. Not been easy since that stinking Al-Anon got started off.
We work the same steps you do, and we know better than that.
I pretended to be, and I went to AA meetings. I'd gone to AA meetings for 6-7 years by that time, off and on in different cities, you know, and I don't know if I heard the same speaker every time, but I always thought I heard the same speaker. And I don't know that I actually heard what he said, but it always seemed to me when I went to an AA meeting, and I was feeling deadly and depressed and edgy and terribly upset. You'd always look up there and there'd be some old fool with hollow cheeks and saying things like, friends,
I stayed drunk for many years, night and day. Alcohol has been my only problem. And then one day I walked through that door, and they told me to put the plug in the jug. And I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy. And I don't know what that did for other people, but it made me salivate. Boom! Is there no place for sensitive, intelligent people? I bet it's in the next town is where it is. But I pretended to be an alcoholic, and I gave them an AA type of story that I know you'd like, and they transferred me to the alcoholic ward finally, and I finally got out. And the funny thing was, I never had another drink till I ran out of Thorazine. When you run out of Thorazine, you have a tendency to get irritable and cross. Well, the next spring, I'd reformed again. I had a lot of people convinced I'm going to make my move. I was working in Dallas at the largest advertising agency in the South, a firm called Tracy Locke. I was writing ads. Some of you old people read them. With Elsie and Elmer the cows talking to each other, and unfortunately Dallas turned out to be full of crap heads. Just and through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, later that same year I woke up one morning and I was on the floor of the Phoenix, Arizona drunk tank, and a guy had just got done kicking my front teeth out because I'd vomited on his bunk. That was one of the few mornings, I'll tell you, that I was glad I'd been in analysis at one time, because once you've been in analysis, you always have an extra insight that enables you to understand things. And I remember lying on the floor there, the guy was kicking my teeth out, and I was too sick to move my head, but I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this man is overreacting. And I got out of there finally. And then I remembered my wife and children had moved into a post office box in Dallas. She got into that rotten Al-Anon, and they poisoned her mind. And seemed kind of cramped for them all in the post office box, but they didn't deserve much. And I'd had somebody taken my luggage, apparently. I'd had two Match Safeway shopping bags, and they were gone. And I thought, I think Seattle is the town. So I started off for Seattle, hitchhiking. And I got as far as Los Angeles, couldn't get out of that stinking town. And I finally went up to the A&A Club. Because when you look bad, you can't really go to the Junior Chamber of Commerce. I was the young man of the year, baby. Yeah. You can't go to the ad club. I'll show you my awards. You kept there with my shopping bags that I lost. But you can always go to A&A because the worse you look, the better you look. There's always, oh, you're a newcomer. Yes, I am. I want to return to God and find sobriety on an all-time basis. They're really simple. And I hung around the AA club for a while, and in a moment of desperation, one night I got caught stealing the money, coffee money at a meeting, and I was banned of the AA club. I was just sick that I, who was going to be something, had sunk to a point where I could be caught by alcoholics. I went out to the beach, something called the Tender Loving Care Club, and lurked around there for a while. And he was going to save alcoholics. He used to be an AA member, but he thought AA was too spiritual, so he had his own group called the Tender Loving Care Club, in which he replaced God, and you turned over all your worldly effects to him, and he saved you. And I was there in a kind of a scholarship. And finally, the AA office and their rotten traditions, as read tonight, always spoil everything. They send him a letter and says, you can't call it AA, whatever you're doing out there. So he threw all the alcoholics out and took in narcotics addicts. And I said to him, Jesus, you never took any narcotics. What are you going to do? He says, I'm not going to get any letters from anybody. He says, people just turn over their worldly effects to me. I'll make it pretty well. And I said, you can't do it. You know, people aren't that crazy. But the next year, he changed his name to Synanon, and it turned out they were that crazy. In fact, if I'd have stuck in Synanon, I would be something today. I wouldn't, when Fred was mean to me at the motel, made me walk in the rain, I wouldn't have had to take it. I'd have whipped a rattler out of my pocket and take that. You. So then I thought, I'll write a book on Skid Row. And I went down to Skid Row, but I didn't have any pencil. And it really was getting brutal by this time because I was down to maybe 115 pounds and no front teeth, and I had a T-shirt and a pair of pants and some old tennies. You think that's funny, huh? Wait till you get to the part where I get cancer. You'll fall off your chair. I don't know why I'm never invited back anywhere. I try to be nice to everybody. Isn't that so, dummy? But I got banned. I got thrown out of the Midnight Mission. Now, a mission on Skid Row, when you get thrown out of there for fighting, it indicates you have a personality problem. I had a terrible time, and I said, "Oh, God, I'll get you, I'll get you." And I had almost died down there. One morning, I went over to sell a pint of blood on East 4th Street to the heart of Skid Row, and they wouldn't take my blood for $4 a pint, because they said the iron content had dropped below the acceptable parameters. And that morning, I knew I was dying, and I remember thinking, Jesus, I wish I were an alcoholic. I wish I were one of those people whose problem was alcohol. I wish my problem were drugs. I wish my problem were anything that I could stop doing and feel better. Instead of these emotions that vary back and forth like winds, and whatever I want, it seems like when I get it, I don't want it. And the only things I want are the things I can't have, and the world is just crappy. I thought maybe I was born in the wrong century or the wrong city or the wrong planet, but something is terribly different about me. And I had to get off the street because it was raining, and I walked 71 blocks to that lousy AA club, and they said I couldn't come in. I said, "My God, it's raining, let me in." He says, "Go in the back room and shut the door and don't let anybody in. Don't let anybody know that I let you in because you're a phony punk." I said, "Oh, that's right." Oh. And I lay on that sofa, and I thought, I'm going to get somebody. I'm going to play their sick little game for a few days. And I'm going to get a hold of some dough and get to Seattle. Because this is a stinking lousy town, too. Maybe in Seattle. That sounds good. I'll pretend to get a sponsor and I'll get some money from him, maybe for a 12-step house. And instead, I'll get a bus to Seattle. And I'll start over again, and I'll be something. Now that I got all these anchors off, and that family won't pull me down. And if I can't get any money from somebody, I'll sit in that parking lot and I'll take a tire iron and I'll give somebody over the head. Because they all have big Chryslers and they say, "Keep coming back, we love you." But they don't seem to show it. And I had no idea that morning or the next day or the next week or the next month that would be my sobriety date. Because I never intended for it to be my sobriety date. But now it's been something over 20 years since that morning. And I haven't had a drink in my body, much to my surprise at first. And it's been something over 20 years since I have been seduced by those well-intentioned but literally deadly members of the medical profession who still feel that alcoholism is caused by a Valium deficiency. You know, I hear some kind of a, "Oh, why did he say that?" Let me tell you something. After I was sober a while, I was working in medical corporations. I become quite friendly with a lot of doctors in AA and out, especially the AA doctors. Now, let me tell you something. I don't judge if you want to take medications. It's none of my business. But let me just tell you something that may or may not interest you. You know why doctors prescribe medications, the Darvon, Valium, Librium, the downer type, for people like you and me? Now, no doctor ever said this to a patient, but I'll tell you what doctors say to doctors. They prescribe those types of prescriptions to people like you and me to keep us quiet so they can take care of people who are really sick. And you may come to me and say, "But my doctor wants me to take these to help me." Not quite true. He wants you to take those to help him. He doesn't want you calling up and, "Doctor, I'm feeling terribly nervous again here. Take this." I'll tell you something. You do not get over an addiction to depressants by being prescribed depressants. You can just take that as a rule of thumb. But you can... I don't judge. We in AA do not judge. We merely report. I have not been interested in those little groups of weeds who grow up around AA every once in a while. Each of them think they're the first. And they say things like,
"Book doesn't mention pot, baby."
And you could just think to yourself, no, but it mentions people who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. And I'll tell you something else. The book does mention it, but I never knew it. Just a couple months ago, I was on an airplane coming from New York, and I was reading my book. I'd read everything else there was to read, so I read that. And I want to point out to you, if you hadn't come to this dinner tonight, you would never have known that this book mentions it. But on page 1, chapter 1 in Bill's story, now how's that? The first paragraph of his story talks about when he was in the army in World War I. And he said he went over there. Second paragraph, "We landed in England. I visited Winchester Cathedral. Much moved, I wandered outside. My attention was caught by an inscription on an old tombstone. Here lies a Hampshire grenadier who caught his death drinking cold small beer. A good soldier is ne'er forgot, whether he dieth by musket or by pot." I don't interpret him, I just read him. But I haven't had the chemicals in my body stronger than an aspirin for over 20 years. And the weirdest thing of all, is that I have had no therapy other than Alcoholics Anonymous since the day I had my last drink. And man, I had a lot of them before that. I'm glad my drinking did not continue a while longer. If I'd have got into the next decade, where I could have danced then through TA and TM and EST and primal therapy.
"I feel better, doctor."
You know, I would have been something, I'll tell you. But all I've had is this same silly AA that wasn't enough for me long before I got sick. And I've come here tonight at tremendous expense. To those of you on the committee, my ticket was $800. And no little inconvenience to talk to you newer people and ask you this important question. Why can't you identify your problem the way we did in the old days? In the old days, we were sincere. I can give you a pretty success story. My first few months sober didn't do very well. I was living in the backseat of an abandoned car. But it was in the AA club parking lot, so there's a certain spiritual aura that fell on me. By the time I was a year sober, I held a job as a busboy without being fired. And after that, I got a job in an advertising agency wrapping packages. Same kind of job I'd had when I was a freshman in high school, and years later, I was doing it again. Then I got a job as a writer, a little bottom writer in a medical corporation. When I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising and public relations of that corporation, because you would go into work every morning will do. By the time I was 7 years sober, I'd become hip and slick again, and another guy and I, they brought us into Hollywood, and we created something called Boss Radio for a station called KHJ, and become the number one hard rock station in America. And when I was 10 years sober, I'd gotten tired of pandering to 13-year-olds. And I was doing public relations with the oil companies downtown, and I'm sorry I did it now. God damn it, I couldn't buy any gas today. When I was 15 years sober, I'd become marketing director of a publishing firm in Beverly Hills, owned a home out by the ocean. When I was 5 years sober, the same wife and children heard the crinkle of green in my wallet all the way to Dallas, Texas. leaped out of their post office box with a hideous cry, fled to my side, snatched my wallet, and I haven't seen it since. 9 months and 10 seconds later, we had a little boy. One and a two and a one. Oddly enough, it's been easing off, and I don't know why, but it struck me why. Because, you know, when I was in the Navy in 1944, they used to put saltpeter in our food. And it was supposed to decrease your sexual drive so you could be on a ship with a lot of guys without getting nervous and edgy and... Hi, Bosun. You know. And it never seemed to have any effect on me at all. And the damnedest thing, it just kicked in a couple of years ago. But isn't that a nice success story? I was down and out and dying on the street, and now I'm up, and I got threads, car, and home, couple bucks, and ha ha ha. This is the time when the speaker looks at the newcomer as if to say, I got it all together, and you haven't. Makes you feel rotten, don't it? And that's a true story. But there's one little thing that sometimes is left out. I leave it out of AA talks. I guess other people do, too. How do you get from there to there? Getting sober don't make it. What the hell is it? I'll tell you, the most important single thing I will say tonight, or I have said, I have already said. I said when I got up, and that's the end of it. When I said that, that was, in a sense, the end of my talk, although I have to explain why. I said, my name is Clancy Immersland, and I'm an alcoholic. And the reason that's so important, that was the single most difficult thing for me to believe in my life. I could say it, and sometimes superficially accept it, but I really never believed it, even after I was sober. Because how can you be an alcoholic when your problem really isn't alcohol? It is sometimes, and sometimes I drink terribly. But unlike other people, when I'm sober, it isn't that good. Now, how can I be an alcoholic if my problem isn't alcohol? I am glad that I survived, and those old guys in AA screwed me up so bad that I changed my values, and I survived long enough to discover that if my problem is alcohol, I am not an alcoholic. Now, doesn't that sound weird? But I'll tell you, in my opinion, if your problem is alcohol, you're in the wrong place. You shouldn't waste your time at AA. Because AA has no tools for two reasons. AA has no tools to deal with an alcohol problem. And even if it did, you don't need it. If your problem is alcohol, as has been said many times, all my life everything is all right except when I drink, and then it just goes to hell. Then I get sober, everything is all right. Then I drink, and everything goes to hell. If that's your problem, I've got a solution for you. You'll never have to waste another meeting in AA. And the answer to an alcohol problem is, don't drink. Then your life is okay all the time. Just don't drink. You don't have to go to these meetings. You can stay home and watch Bowling for Dollars and have fun. Play cards with the people next door. Oh. Work on your garden. But if it turns out that you suffer from what it turned out I suffer from, you may go to your grave very painfully over a period of years and never have the slightest clue what the hell was wrong. Because if your problem is alcohol, you are not an alcoholic. What makes an alcoholic is something that sounds the same a little bit, and we talk a lot about drinking, but it isn't alcohol. It's something called alcoholism. Now, what's the difference? They sound the same, a three-letter suffix. What difference does that make? It's just this difference. If your problem is alcohol, when you get sober, no further therapy is required. You just say, man, that stuff has eaten me up. I ain't going to drink it anymore. And you adjust and you live happily ever after. But if you suffer from alcoholism, when you get sober, unfortunately, it looks exactly the same. It looks the same to your family. It looks the same to your employer, to your clergyman, to your neighbors. And most deadly, it looks exactly the same to the patient. Because nobody ever seems to know in those situations that the difference between alcohol and alcoholism is alcoholism continues on after you're sober. But nobody ever recognizes it because your voice doesn't slur and you don't stumble and fall down. And alcoholism, when you're sober, seems to manifest itself by the disease almost centering itself in human emotions and warping perspectives of reality and making things look different. And no matter what anybody says, truth is as I see it. You can all tell me that wall is red, but it looks to me like it's light blue, no matter what anybody says. And truth is as the way I see it. And if my perspectives are warped, if I have an emotional color blindness, it looks to me like I'm the only one seeing it right, and they're wrong, and they're just trying to screw me up. Or they don't understand. And the hallmark of alcoholism is that eventually sobriety, sustained reality, becomes so full of conflict and your emotions against people and places and things, and you dig into yourself and you study and you look and you get introverted, and you one day you get to a point where you have to drink to resolve these emotions, or take pills, or smoke marijuana, or do something. But it just gets to be too much, and everybody knows about it. But you know, by that time, my problem really isn't alcohol. Because I'm sober now, and I see these situations. It's this. It's the way they make me feel. It's what they're doing. It's my memories. It's what might have been. It's all the things. But sooner or later, I'm going to drink. Now, having sobriety be untenable doesn't make you an alcoholic, however. Because there's millions of people who live in reality and find it very uncomfortable. But they're not alcoholics. Because something else has to happen. They're called intense neurotics. But something else has to be present. Alcohol has to do something special in your body that it doesn't do to most people. Alcohol has to perform the function of altering your perspectives of reality. Alcohol has to have an effect that none of us ever dreamed it was doing. Makes you feel better without knowing that what it's doing, it's making the same things look different. It literally induces a form of temporary psychosis. Now, alcohol, if it does that, it gives you an out from neurosis. But you can't stay drunk, and you always get sober again, and there you're back there again, repentant or don't care. Or it's kind of a funny thing about alcoholics. People always say, don't you care about these things? You hear that? See that finger in your... And you don't even think to say, don't you understand? I seem to care more than anybody. That's what makes me feel so bad. I care more than anybody. So, scientists who study alcoholics say that sustained reality to an alcoholic, some who is on the wagon or dry, eventually gets them to a point, in many cases, where they must drink to literally preserve their sanity. If you don't drink, you flip out. And then you go to AA and they say, if you do drink, you're going to flip out. Christ, they don't leave you much. But the one thing you know is I'm not really an alcoholic because I have these other situations that they don't understand. And that's why nearly everybody who has this disease dies from it. And that's why in a crowd like this of AA members, probably most of us will die from it. Not tonight, over a period of time, when you get well enough to say, I don't have to do that AA crap anymore. I'm sober. I know about it. They, you know, that one of the great misquotations in all of Alcoholics Anonymous is used to seduce people into taking things for granted. They say, as Bill Wilson said, 50% of the people who walk through that door will never drink again. 25% will drink and then come back, and 25% we don't know what happens to them. That never was said anywhere. It was taken from a talk that Bill Wilson gave to the American Mental Health Association when AA got the Lasker Award in 1951 for being the most significant progress in American public health. But they always misquote it. What he said was, we have found that 50% of the people who come to our through our doors and make an earnest attempt to work this program never drink again. But they always leave out that little qualifying phrase. It makes it sound if you just stagger through the door, you're going to stay sober. You're not. Because this is the only illness in the world where one of the most lethal symptoms is your own brain telling you you haven't really got it. Because then you can have relief and justify it. So you get to a point finally when drinking is starting to eat you up. And then you say, I'm going to straighten up and be sober. And much to your chagrin, you find sobriety eventually more painful than the memory of drinking. So you're going to drink, and then you're going to get sober, and drink and get sober. And that particular state of mind and body is called alcoholism. Now, alcohol seems to do something strange. You know, I thought about this when I was about a year, as I say, a little over a year sober. I was wrapping packages in this advertising agency. One of our accounts was Kamchatka Vodka. I was not a writer. They wouldn't allow me to do that. I looked terrible. I didn't have any front teeth. I just was peddling the mail. But I thought these guys were deciding what to put on the Kamchatka billboard. And I came by them peddling the mail. I thought, maybe today is the day that I'll let them know that I'm not just some dummy without front teeth, that I used to be something, and I'm a brilliant man. And so I came by, I said, I got an idea, guys. Why don't you just put on your billboard, Kamchatka Vodka goes boom, better than all vodkas everywhere. And I, good idea. And they all looked at me funny and said, why don't you peddle your goddamn mail? You know, And I whined to my sponsor that night about it. I said, my God, it just shows you. They don't want to hear that's a good billboard, and they won't even give it a chance. And he said, no, you're mistaken, dummy. Like I've been telling you for a year. I had a sponsor. I wasn't able to get a class sponsor. I had one that unfortunately was interested in what I was doing. And he said, don't you understand? They don't know what the hell you're talking about. Kamchatka Vodka doesn't go boom to them. It goes blah, blah, blah. That's why you're at the meeting and they're not. The next time that you think wish you were the next time you wish you were a social drinker and had always been a social drinker, I think that's ridiculous. I don't think any of us could ever satisfy to be a social drinker once you had it the other way. Now, can you imagine what it must be like for those people to go through their whole lives and they get the back to the wall and the hounds of fate ripping at their throat? And they take a big drink and say, oh God, and have it go blah, blah, blah. No wonder they say things like, oh, no more for me, I'm starting to feel it. Yeah. That's a hell of a way to live, folks. They will never know what we all take for granted. When your back's to bend to the wall and the hounds are ripping at your throat, you take a drink. Oh, God. And it doesn't go blah, blah. It goes bring on your goddamn hound, Mrs. Baskerville. Do you know any therapy in the world of any kind that can take a suicidal depressive and in 15 minutes, by the proper applications of medicines, he could be leaning on a bar with a small smile playing around his pallid lips and saying things like, you with anybody, Granny? Yeah. Nothing has changed, but it looks different. It looks different. Remember one time in El Paso, my wife and I were waiting for the alcoholic friend, household finance, to call. They were going to call at 10 o'clock to tell us whether or not they had decided to, whether we were going to repossess our furniture or extend the loan. And there was a lot of tension in the house when you live with a non-alcoholic who has no understanding of fate. And it was about 10 to 10, and everybody was very nervous. And I was into my rum and wicker basket phase at that time. And I offered my wife a drink. I said, "Charlotte, would you like a little drink?" And she gave me that non-alcoholic Al-Anon. You know.
"My God, what's wrong with you? You're failing your life. You want to ruin mine, too. So is you."
"Ah, shut up." "Yeah. Some people can't accept kindness." And I took a couple of belts of the old rum. And by the time the phone rang, I was the only one prepared to answer it. And I heard myself say, "You keep up with this shit, I ain't going to borrow from you anymore." Nothing had changed. It just looked different somehow. Now, if alcohol does that for you, eventually sobriety must become untenable to you. And when that time comes, that is called alcoholism. A deadly, frightening, brutal thing. We joke about it in AA meetings, but there isn't a person here who to one degree or another has not felt the cold hand on their throat of saying, oh my God, what can I do? And that's why I would suggest to you that maybe it might be of interest to you to contemplate the possibility that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a place to go and get sober. Detox is where you go to get sober. Toilet bowls are where you go to get sober. Hospitals you can get sober. On the lawn you can get sober. If you can't get sober, I've heard a lot of guys say, "I'd give anything to get off this drunk. I'd do anything." I found a way 28 years ago that I share with people. Slap a cop. You'll be off it before you know it, folks. The purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the reason that many of us, I do anyway, maybe that you get a sponsor, even though you may think it makes you look inadequate, and get a sponsor whom you cannot manipulate, because otherwise you haven't got a sponsor. And the reason you go to a lot of meetings, and the reason we suggest you get involved and do these things, and over a period of time at your sponsor's guidance, take these 12 steps that don't seem to have any application until after you take them. The reason you do these things is not to make you wonderful or spiritual. Sometimes people get so spiritual in AA, they float right out the top. You say, "I no longer need meetings. I walk alone with God." And that sounds nice, except such people always seem to be coming back and saying, "One day God asked me to have a beer." Yeah. You think if you could believe in God, if you could find a belief in God, you wouldn't need AA. But I've been flown across the country 3 times now to speak to groups of clergymen in the hospitals in the East, where the church sends their clergymen from all over the world so that AAs can teach them how to stay sober. And they believe more about God when they're coming in there sick than the people who are teaching them, in a sense, in a classic sense. So it isn't that, to become wonderful. The purpose of AA is something, it's so obvious that it's so terribly complex that you can't hardly grasp it for a while. And you got to do these things for a while before you start to understand it. And that is this.